The following audio is brought to you by Summerside Community Church in London, Ontario. For more information on Summerside, visit us online at www.summersidechurch.ca.
So, I have a beautiful family. I'm very thankful to God for that, right? And everybody loves to share photos of their children. And have you ever noticed how it's much more fun to share photos than to be shared with? Like, if somebody shows you pictures of their kids, maybe it's just me. I'm always like measuring my face and trying to be like, okay, make sure you seem invested enough, you know, like, the, like, oh, that's really cute little one that you have there. And oh yeah, they look just like you, or, you know, trying to be something positive, but largely, you know what it's like. You don't really care that much about other people's kids, right? Maybe you do. Maybe you're a real softy. And so, as many of you know, when we were working through the adoption with my firstborn, with Patrick, I had a lot of people texting me and being like, oh my goodness, this is amazing. Do you have any photos? And for some perverse reason, I kept sharing this photo and said, introduce you to my beautiful baby. And I don't really know why I kept sharing that. And yes, you're like, that is not, I don't think that's a real baby. I should have Googled if that's a real, because it looks like Mr. Bean, right? It's Mr. Bean baby. Maybe you're like, wait a second, did you get that from my mom's, you know, photo albums from when I was a kid? I mean, it's just grotesque, right? And it's just a way that I, you know, get a laugh out of people or something like that, or make people pause or kind of see how they would respond to be like, oh yes, it's beautiful. And the best one I got was, wow, what a gift from God. He looks just like you. So, but the whole point is, the joke is that the image doesn't reflect reality, right? I mean, that image is not reflective of the beautiful gift that God has given me. And that's kind of the joke, right? And maybe you've experienced this. Has anybody ever tagged you in a photo on Facebook and you're like, come on. Out of all the photos that you took of that event, that's the one you're going to post of me? And you're thinking, you know what? You don't understand. You know, it was a bad hair day and you got my bad side and my posture was off, you know, and you caught me, you know, eating a big plate of chips or something, right? It's just kind of like a bad photo. And you think, why would you post that? That's not who I am. And, or maybe you're like, maybe you should have looked at Instagram and found a really good filter to try to, you know, improve things and edit it. Because basically the point is we want the image to reflect reality, right? We want the image to reflect reality. And today we're looking at the second of the Big Ten, the second commandment that God gives to his people in the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments, if you don't know, are like the heart of the Old Testament as far as law goes. Here are 10 rules, God says. Here's how I want you to live as my people. Here's what people who are in relationship with me are called to live out. 5 relate to our relationship with God, and generally 5 relate to our relationship with others. Incredible. The first one is to have no other gods. We looked at that last week. If you weren't here, you can check that out on the podcast. Have no other gods. And that means that we are called to not only believe in the one true God, but to give ourselves to him and not to anything else. It doesn't just mean what we believe, but it's about our affections and about our love and our heart. Don't give yourself to other gods. And today, the second commandment kind of piggybacks off of that. We are called to not believe in another God, and the second commandment is to not make idols. Don't bow down to them, don't worship them, don't make idols. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to open up to the Old Testament, we're going to look at this commandment, we're going to talk through the verses, and then we're going to see what difference does this make for us today. How do we, as people in 2018, come face to face with idols? How do we work this through? What does it mean? If you call yourself a follower of Christ, what does it mean for you to not follow idols? If you are not yet a follower of Christ, I hope that this challenges you to examine, that you may claim that you don't worship a God or that you don't give yourself to a God, but in our hearts we long for something to worship. It's either the true God or it's a substitute. So open your Bibles up to Exodus chapter 20. I'm going to ask you to keep them open because we're going to kind of work through each of the verses. Exodus chapter 20, verse 40. Exodus is the second book of the Old Testament. So you have Genesis, the creation of man and woman and all that. And then you come to Exodus, the story of God delivering his people, God rescuing his people from Egyptian slavery, calling them out into the wilderness and claiming this people as his own and making them his own as he shapes them, as he reveals himself to them, calling them deeper into relationship with him. And that is the context of the Big Ten. The context of the Big Ten, these Ten Commandments, is the relationship is established by God. And so how is this relationship going to be continued? When God's people respond and live out the way that he calls them to. So let's look at Exodus chapter 20. We're going to look today at verses 4 to 6. Here's what it says. You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above, on the earth beneath, or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. For I, the Lord, your God, am a jealous God. We'll come back to that. Punishing the children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me. We'll come back to that. But showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandment. It's very simple in one sense. He says, don't make idols. Don't fashion. The Hebrew word talking about making idols is literally referring to something that is carved or chiseled, you know, some kind of pottery, some kind of like clay figurine, perhaps a golden statue or something. You know, and for us, this doesn't mean a whole lot because generally we don't have these symbols of our gods that we literally believe in that are permeating everywhere. But this was very common in the ancient world. So God tells Israel, don't make idols. You don't need idols because I'm going to reveal myself to you. Secondly, Israel can't make an idol of God because there's no way that they can capture God. Right? God is the eternal creator, the one and only God who existed before time, who has always existed, who controls all things. How is Israel going to capture that? How are you and I going to fashion something that does justice to God? So he says, do not make for yourself, verse 4, an image in the form of anything in heaven above, the earth beneath, or the waters below. Here's the point. There is nothing in creation that can capture the Creator. There is nothing that we see or that we experience. There is nothing in the created order that can accurately and fully capture all that God is. Right? How many of you have seen, any of you are a soccer fan, how many of you have seen the terrible carving of Ronaldo? Anybody see that? Oh, this is, okay, we got a couple, thank you. So they commissioned this bronze bust of this, you know, incredibly handsome, gifted athlete, right? And it's horrible. I should have put an image up. You can Google that later, guys. I know I gave you the Wi-Fi passwords in the bulletin, but it's not for Googling Ronaldo, okay? It's just, it's horrible, cringeworthy. So they had to recommission it. The image didn't reflect reality, and that was the problem. And if you look at the wording here, and if you take this out of context, somebody could ask a question, does this mean that art is prohibited? Because he says don't make an image of anything, right? Does that mean that art is wrong or that art is useless or that art is somehow sinful? Well, no. I mean, when you look at the Old Testament, there's a number of instances in which God celebrates art or he commissions it. The first spiritual gift in the Bible comes to those who are building the temple and those who are crafting so that their work would be beautiful and would be God-honoring. The temple was beautiful. The veil of the temple that separated the holy place from the most holy of holies was said to be a picture of a beautiful panoramic, a kind of celestial image, the stars and the heavens. It was beautiful. Solomon's temple, the priest's garments. There is tons of art in the Bible, and God celebrates it. Right? We are made in God's image. God is a creator God, and when we create, we bring him glory. Right? So it's not saying you can't do art or that art is useless or don't make an image of anything, but it's talking specifically, if you look at verse 5, about what we worship, about what we give ourselves to. This then raises an important question. Is it wrong to depict God in art? Oh, we don't have any super opinionated people on this. I was just waiting for somebody to scream out. Think about the context. I think that's the most important part of the answer. What is he talking about here? He's talking about worship. He is talking about taking the infinite God and reducing him down so that in effect you can control him, you can capture him, and you can worship him. You know, when you look at something like the Sistine Chapel, where you have the creation of man and woman, that scene, a beautiful image, powerful image. Is that wrong to depict God in art? There's a lot of stuff in the Bible that's black and white. And there's some that requires a little bit of reflection and study and dependence on the Spirit of God living in you. So I would say this, if you are the type of person or if you have an experience or a religious upbringing where you can't worship without an image or an icon of Jesus or of God or something, I want to challenge you on that. I want to challenge you that you don't need that because God through His Spirit lives in us. And so I don't believe that there's anything particularly wrong with an icon or these incredible paintings. You think of William Blake, who painted The Ancient of Days. I don't think there's anything particularly wrong. The issue is a heart issue. If only it was as simple as just saying, here's all the rules that we need to follow, and everything's simple if you just follow them. Life is much more complex than that. We take the truth of Scripture and we apply it out. And so I would say this, if you are tempted to worship these images, if you cannot worship, if you feel unsafe in your home because there's not a crucifix hanging, I think that there's a problem. What about actors who play Jesus? Is that okay? Right? If it's bad art, you're right, it's not. Right? Again, do you recognize that if God in His providence had chosen to come in 2018, there would be photos of Jesus? He was real and really human and fully human. You could have seen Him. You could have described Him to other people, right? Like He literally walked among us. He was real. Again, if you have an image of Jesus and you are tempted to worship it, get rid of it. Good luck, though. I mean, what are you going to do with it? How do you get rid of it if you worship it, right? That's difficult. But process through that. You don't need an image to worship God. But when we see these things depicted in art, I don't particularly have a huge problem with it. If you struggle to worship it and it draws your heart away from the one true God as He is revealed in His Word, then get rid of it. You don't need it. If your temptation is to want to reduce God down, then get rid of it. You don't need it. God, by His Spirit, lives in those who have experienced the new birth. You don't need any of that stuff. You are no closer to God. God is no more present in your home if you have a cross hanging or something like that. Do you understand? So I would say, again, the issue is deeper than just yes or no. The issue is your heart. Do you worship this? And if so, get rid of it. You don't need it. Look at verse 5. He says this, "You shall not bow down to them or worship them." So don't make idols, first of all, and then don't bow down and don't worship them. Don't give yourselves to them. Why? Because I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sins of the parents to the third and the fourth generations of those who hate me. I am a jealous God, he says. What are you going to do with that? First of all, let me explain that the Old Testament, right, is written in Hebrew, a little bit of Aramaic, but it's written in Hebrew. And so it's translated by incredible scholars from Hebrew into English. On my honeymoon, I was studying Hebrew, literally. This is such a lame thing. Just going through cue cards, I can remember this. And actually, it was our one-year anniversary, excuse me. We went back to the same place that we had our honeymoon. And I was studying Hebrew flashcards. I think Heather was in the bathroom or something like that. And I was just brushing up. I had an exam coming up. And the waiter came over and was like, "Oh, what are you doing?" So I explained it. And he's like, and he instantly leaned in. He's like, "So, like, does the Bible, like, do they mess it up? And, you know, is it different in English? You know, like a different message?" I was like, "No, not at all." Right? The Bible translation that you have in front of you is an incredible work of scholarship. Incredible. They agonize over grammatical terms that most of us don't even understand in English. Okay? So what we have here is incredibly accurate. But whenever you're translating from a different language, there's always a little bit of nuance that's easy to miss. We, in 2018, perceived the word jealous as a type of petty, insecure, vindictive, controlling type emotion. Right? If you described yourself, or somebody described you as, "Oh yeah, he's a super jealous husband," right? That would have a connotation. The original Hebrew here, and the theme of this word throughout the Bible is more than that. It's not coming from a place of insecurity. It's more of a sense of zealousness or a sense of passion, right? Let me give you an example. Let's say that you drop some flowers off at my house for my wife. Let's say that you start writing her little notes, and you're a dude, okay? Let's say that you drop by and have a nice piece of jewelry for her, and let's say that you're trying to call her. How do you think I'm going to respond? I'll tell you how I'll respond. As your Christian brother, I would give you many opportunities to practice the art of turning the other cheek, right? It's like, that's not okay. Don't do that. Right? She's my wife. She's mine. Just like if somebody was doing that to me, she would say, "Don't touch. He's mine." We're jealous. And there's a sense in which that word is misunderstood today, but whether you call it zealous or you call it jealous or protective, here's the truth. God has redeemed Israel. He is the one who came in and rescued them from their bondage. He is their creator and their redeemer. When they give themselves to idols, it ticks him off. He's jealous for them. He's zealous for them. He knows that if they turn to idols, they will be destroyed. And so he says to them, "Don't go looking for idols. I'm the one who purchased you. I'm the one who delivered you. I'm the one who rescued you. You are mine." There's a sense in which one of the overarching themes throughout the Old Testament is Israel as the bride, as the wife of God. He pursues her even when she's unfaithful. He loves her. He woos her. She just keeps chasing after idols. You can see that in the prophets. God is the one who rescues. God is the one who delivers. And he says to Israel, "You are mine. Don't go after idols. They won't satisfy you. They won't fill you up. I'm the one who's delivered you. Don't go after idols." Then it continues. Look at the rest of verse 5 here. He says, I'm a jealous God. We walked through that. It's not petty. It's not insecure. It's not vindictive. He's possessive because he purchased them. And he's looking and working for their good. He says, I am the God who what? Punishing the children for the sins of the parents to the third and the fourth generations. Again, very complex, very tricky, right on a surface reading. Save the cross, except for the cross. God does not judge a person for another person's sins. Okay? We're all responsible. That means that you can't blame your life, your lifestyle, your decisions on other people, that ultimately we stand before God and answer for the decisions that we've made. In the cross, though, God does something incredible where he allows Jesus to play the role of the substitute. And we'll talk more about that in just a few minutes. But here's the thing. Your decisions affect more than just yourself. Right? The decisions that you make impact and affect other people, specifically in the context of family. Parents, you have no idea your ability to either set your children up for success in life or your ability and your power to destroy them. The relationship between a son and a father, the relationship between a son and his mother, the relationship between a daughter and her dad or a daughter and her mother, there is no ability almost to overestimate the impact that parents have. And what God is saying here is that if you, Israel, go after idols, if you chase after them, it's going to impact generations. And we see that specifically in the exile, where God patiently wooing his bride, calling her back, saying, Israel, come back to me. Israel, come back to me. Stop following false gods. Eventually, he allows judgment to come. And the people go off into exile. They are captured and led away. The sins of the parents impact the future generations. And we see that even in our own society. Right? We see that in homes that children grow up without a father figure. And the devastation that that can bring. Now, by God's good grace and the good community of people who love Jesus, positive male role models, positive influences are available, and I praise God for that. You think about generational sin. So many of us parent or experience married life, or live out those kinds of relationships, not coming from a place where we've really thought through how we're going to do this, but simply living out the patterns that we've experienced in our own upbringing, right? The decisions that we make impact future generations. And God is calling Israel here, and he says, don't do it. If you give yourselves to idols, the effects of that negative decision, the effects of that sin is going to ripple throughout generations. Now look at verse 6. But showing love to a thousand generation of those who love me and keep my commandment. Those who love him and keep his commands. There is good things for. He ends with a message of hope. He says, don't go after idols because they lead to destruction. And I am the God who shows love to a thousand generations for those who love me and keep my commandments. In one sense, it's pretty straightforward, right? Don't worship idols. Don't make them. Don't give yourselves to them. Stay away from them. You know, it comes up a lot in the Old Testament. It even comes up in the New Testament. But what does this mean for us? I'm sure that very few of you are like, yeah, I like church and all, but the whole time I'm at church, I'm like, I can't wait to go home and bust open my idol closet and, you know, look at my little idol and, you know, offer it like some finger blood or something or do some chants. I love my idols. They're so amazing, right? I've been working all week on this one. Look, it looks like Thor a little bit, doesn't he, right? Like realistically, I'm sure very few of us are tempted by physical idols that represent deities. There are places in the world where Christians coming from different cultures do struggle with this and do wrestle with this, where churches, you know, navigate through this with them. But if only it was that simple. If only you could sit here and say, I don't have any idols that I'm hiding in my closet. That means that I've nailed the second commandment. Right? That means I've knocked this one out of the park. Because again, the issue is the heart. I want to give you a few definitions here of an idol to help us think this through. Because I'm convinced in 2018, in a Western culture, in a Western context like we live, the temptation for idolatry is even more dangerous because it's so subtle. An idol is anything you look to in the hopes of getting what only God can give. It's the thing of which you think, I can't live without it. It's the thing to which you look to find your identity, your security, and your meaning in life. And instantly it becomes clear that the temptation towards idolatry is more than just harboring a little carved figure. It's more than just worshiping a giant golden statue. It's an issue of the heart. An idol is anything that you look to in the hopes of getting what only God can give. John Calvin famously wrote that the human mind or the human heart is a perpetual forge of idols. That because we are created by God, we desire something to give ourselves to. We desire something to worship. Augustine put it this way from the fourth century. Incredible pastor and theologian said this: you have made us, God, for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you. We long for instinctively something to give ourselves to. And if it's not God, it's going to be something else. If it's not God, the Creator and the Redeemer, it's going to be something else. So this makes us work through, or this makes us understand that there's two important realizations for us as we apply this. Here's the first one. We are all tempted by idols. Don't think for a second that you're not. So let me ask you, what is the one thing that you desire above all else? What is the one thing you find yourself dreaming about, fantasizing about, planning to get, working to possess? What is your one great obsession? What is the focus of your heart? What is it that you long for? There's a good chance that whatever that is functions as your idol. It could be an addiction, right? Those are pretty evident. You know, you think about anything from alcoholism to drug abuse, pornography, gambling. You're looking to that in the moment to give you something. To give you something that only God can give us. And so you get a temporary high, or you have a fix, or you get absolutely plastered and it feels good in the moment, but it never satisfies, right? Because we're not meant for that. Maybe your idol is an addiction. And as soon as I talk about it, you know exactly what I'm referring to. But maybe it's something even more subtle. It's been said that an idol can be a good thing turned into a God thing. Think about your identity. It would be very easy for me to make ministry or make my position to be an idol. Right? That's how I define myself. That's how I want to be known. That's what I slip into conversation. Finding my identity in my profession, right? Because, you know, I'm a holy man and all that, right? Man of the cloth. I like how I heard my wife laugh the loudest there. That was good. Where do you find your identity? When you're insecure, when you're hurting, where do you turn? When somebody challenges you, when you feel exposed, what do you turn to? It can be a good thing. Maybe your idol is having the perfect little Christian family. Right? And you're just so proud of it. You make sure that everybody else knows that, and all of your Facebook posts are trying to communicate how perfect your family is. It's possible that your idol can be a good thing. Maybe it's Bible knowledge, and you just love learning more and more and more and more and more, even though your heart is growing oddly colder and colder and colder towards God. But you love to wield this hammer around of your theological knowledge and impress people or scare people or contradict people or confront people because, you know, you're the one with all the answers. There's no end to the things that you and I can make idols. Maybe it's your achievements. For some, it's sexuality. For some, it's pride or position or likes on Instagram, security. Maybe it's money. And the more you have, the safer you feel. And that feeling of safety, that hope for the future, is meant to be provided by God. Maybe it's comfort or pleasure. Maybe your entire life is devoted to doing only what you want to do. Whether you're here and you're 5 years old or you're 105, don't think for a second that you can escape the pull of an idol. Maybe it's having the perfect family, like I said. Maybe it's having the perfect body. Maybe it's accomplishments or degrees or a career. Where do you go when you feel that insecurity? Where do you go when you feel that fear of the future? We're all tempted by idols, and don't think for a second that you can escape. And maybe you're like, okay, well, sure. My entire life is built around this one obsession, and I don't really care that much. I enjoy it, right? Straight up, maybe you're here and you're not a follower of Christ, and you would say, okay, it's clearly not God. I don't really care that much about it. It's this, or it's this, or it's this, or it's this. Why should I care? Let me give you the second realization. Not only are we all tempted by idols, but hear me very clearly. Idols will never satisfy. Idols will never give you what it is that you're seeking. If an idol is anything we give ourselves to in the hopes of getting what only God can give, we're never going to get the real thing. I say this, and you know it, right? You know that it doesn't satisfy. It feels good. There's definitely a payoff. But a few days later, you're back with your nose to the grind, pursuing the same ends. It never fully satisfies because we are not made to find our ultimate satisfaction in idols. God is the one who gives satisfaction. He has made us. We are His creations. He knows us. He knows our hearts. He knows our longings. He knows the purpose of your life and why you were created. He is the one who provides our security, our identity, our hope, our safety. Idols cannot satisfy. Here's another stark realization as well. Not only will they never satisfy, idols will never forgive you. Idols will never offer you grace. Think about it. If your idol is having this prestigious career, what happens if the market fluctuates and you lose your job? If that is your idol and you let your idol down in that kind of way, you're going to be destroyed. You'll have no sense of identity. If your idol is your bank account, right? And how much you have, what happens if your investments fail? Right? What happens? You've let your idol down and you have no hope. You have nothing else to cling to. If your idol is having a perfect body, guess what? It's not going to be around forever. Right? Eventually, gravity takes its toll. If it's on having the perfect family, what happens when one of your children makes a really stupid decision? Do you see what I'm saying? Idols will never satisfy, and if you ever let them down, they will not be able to offer you grace. What is that thing that consumes you? What is that thing that calls you? That thing you want to give yourself to? That one thing that you think, if only I could achieve this, have this, or secure this, my life would be complete. Whatever that is your idol. And I want to challenge you, and I want to invite you to find your satisfaction, not in an idol, but in the true and the living God, your creator, your maker, and your redeemer, the only one who can satisfy. Idols don't satisfy. And idols, if you let them down, will never offer you grace. So let me ask you, what is that one thing that you obsess over? What is that one thing that consumes your thought? What is that one thing you want to lead with and be known for? What do you look to give you that meaning and that identity in your life? And what do you love most? I guess that's the simplest way to frame it. What do you love the most? What is your hope in? If it's in an idol, it's not going to satisfy. Put your hope in the living God. So God comes to his people and he says, don't make an image. Don't make an image of any kind. Run from idols. They will not satisfy you. You don't need an empty God. You don't need an image. Why? Partly because the image of God was coming. See, we don't have to guess. We don't have to sit here and reduce God down. We have the incredible reality of the incarnation of Jesus. That Jesus, the Son of God, the eternal God, stepped into human history, born of a virgin, the God-man who walked and taught, who healed, who went to the cross, who died in our place and was resurrected from the dead. The image of God was coming. Israel, God says, you don't need to figure out what I'm like. You don't need to make me tactile because I'm coming myself someday. Colossians chapter 1, verse 15, Paul says this. He, that is the Son is the image of the invisible God. And you and I who have trusted in Jesus, who have seen what he has done for us on the cross and say, I want this, not these false idols. Jesus, I believe that you died on the cross for my sins and I'm yours. Take me. Those who call out to Jesus to be rescued have the Spirit of God living in us. We have God's word here, which describes God to us, which reveals God to us, which shows us what he is like. We don't need idols. Either little carved things or these subtle idols like achievement and fame and recognition and money. We don't need it because the Son of God has come. God in the flesh, the image of God walking among us, who reveals himself to us through his Spirit and through his word. Summerside, every day we are bombarded with invitations to give ourselves to idols. If only you had this. If only you did this. If only you were with this person. If only you had this much in your bank account. Then you would find your joy and satisfaction. And my prayer is that we as a church living in a hostile and broken world would keep ourselves from idols. That we would be a people who live and worship and act vastly different than our community, vastly different than our neighbors. Who love God above all else. And love our neighbor as ourself as we fulfill the great commandments today. Summerside, I invite you, keep yourselves from idols. Because they won't satisfy. The image of God has come. Give yourself to Jesus. Let me pray. Father, there was a time where perhaps it was evident what idols were. You know, little carved figures that people were tempted by. And I confess even in my own heart how undiscerning or uncareful I've been over the years and given myself to this idea that this will complete me or this is what I truly need or God, that I've just given myself to idols, and I confess that to you. And Father, we all know deep down that none of these idols satisfy. They're good for a moment, but they don't help us long term. They don't answer our deepest questions about, why am I here? Does my life even matter? Do the decisions that I make any difference? And God, our idols cannot answer these questions. But you, who are our creator and our redeemer, you have answers. And you have the satisfaction that our souls crave. Jesus, keep us from idols because they pale in comparison to what you offer us. Forgive us, strengthen us, and help us as we live this out and point people to you, the one thing that can truly satisfy. Amen.